91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Have you ever thought about how that brilliant, multi-pointed, faceted diamond on your finger came to be, or how it was found? Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We begin this hour with Florida International University's Dr. Stephen Haggerty, a geologist in the Earth and Environment section of the School of Environment, Arts, and Society. Diamonds are pure carbon. They're sort of natural antiques and brought to the surface volcanically. Haggerty's made a discovery about how diamonds may be more easily found. Stay tuned for more information. Later in the hour, we use Valentine's Day as a starting point for a discussion with relationship, life, and motivation coach Barb Brochetto. She declares she has a PhD from the School of Life. First, it's news. And we return to today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Today we take quite a scientific bent. We'll speak with a Florida International University geologist.
He's Dr. Stephen Haggerty, who years ago was a principal investigator in the U.S. Apollo and Soviet Luna sample return programs.
He's also the first person I think we've interviewed who actually has had a metallic mineral named for him. It's called Haggertyite.
Dr. Stephen Haggerty obtained his PhD in geology and geophysics from London University. He's a distinguished research professor in the Department of Earth and Environment in the College of Arts and Sciences at Florida International University.
And he's here on Valentine's Day to talk about, what else, diamonds, how they're formed, and most importantly, about his theory of where to find them.
Welcome to you, Dr. Haggerty.
Thank you very much, Nate.
Great to have you. This has been a pretty fascinating discussion we've been having here before the show. Now we're going to have it on the air. First of all, I'd like to know what a diamond is and why your great interest in and passion for them.
Right. So diamond is among the very few minerals that occur on the Earth, of which there are some 4,500, that's made of a single element. That single element is carbon, the same carbon that gives rise to graphite, for example, the graphite that is used in pencils. Now, the extraordinary feature, and there are several, is one, graphite is extremely soft, whereas diamond, at the other end of the spectrum, is extraordinarily hard, so hard that it remains the hardest material known to man or indeed produced by man.
Harder than steel.
Much, much harder than steel. Mm. In fact, so much so, if I might just continue with regard to the hardness. So diamonds were first found in India, some 4,000 BCE, that is before the Common Era. In other words, 2,000 years BC, beyond that. The extraordinary feature in the Upanishads is written, this stone can only be scratched by this stone. Recognizing that it was only diamond that indeed could scratch, and as we now know, can both cut and polish diamond. But that was recognized more than 2,000 years ago.
So that is why it was first prized for its hardness
indeed,
to affect other minerals and metals.
Correct. And also because the diamonds that were found in India were also very brilliant. A large number of them are gem quality. So unlike the industrial stones that are very common, those from India are quite, quite brilliant. And the Hope Diamond is one in the Smithsonian, for example.
What do diamonds tell us about the history of the Earth? I mean, how old are they? And what do they tell us about the Earth's history?
Well, that was the attraction that that I've had to diamonds, is that you may find it difficult to believe, but it's true, is that I have actually very little interest in both the aesthetics of diamond and the use to which they are put. The use to which they are put industrially is important. But what does it tell us about the interior of the Earth? One, diamonds are consistently among the oldest minerals on Earth, having formed between 2.8 and 3.2 billion years ago.
That's billion with a B.
Billion with a capital B, I might add. But so that 3,000 amongst it, all diamonds are about 3,000 million years old. Now, given the age of the Earth, which is about 4.5 billion years old, there was this extraordinary period of time in Earth's history at about 3 billion years. We don't know what it was, but that's the age of diamonds, whether they're from China, Australia, Africa, or Siberia. They're all of about the same age. And they're dated by a variety of different radiometric techniques. So they consistently zoom in on this one particular age, a very important age, as I say. We don't understand what the event was.
You don't. So you don't know why they were produced, why all this carbon was produced 2.8 to 3.2 billion years ago. Correct. And turned to diamond.
That's correct. The one thing we can say is that a very large proportion of the carbon that went into form diamond was primordial. It originated in the Earth when the Earth and our planetary system formed.
So is it on other planets?
Correct. Moreover, the diamonds that are found in meteorites, okay, these are older than the solar system. They're older than 4.5 billion years old. So the diamonds on Earth, once again, are 3 billion years. Those in meteorites are greater than 4.5 billion. So those formed in outer space before our planetary system condensed into form the sun and all of the planets. Whether they occur on other planets in our solar system is not known. We've only visited Mars, for example. No diamonds are found there. But what is interesting is that just last year, from the flyby messenger, we have a lot of data now on Mercury. So Mercury is the first planet to the sun. And by golly, there's a layer of graphite on the surface.
Oh.
In addition to that, one other way of forming diamonds on Earth, and we have good evidence probably on other planets, is that by meteorite impact, the high pressures that are created and the transient, the very short period of time for high temperatures, we can form diamonds by impact. Now, looking at...
From graphite?
From graphite or carbon.
Any carbon.
Yes,
okay.
Indeed. That's right, Bonnie. So when one looks at the surface of Mercury, pockmarked as it is, with an old layer of graphite, there must be diamonds there. Every single pockmark that is now a meteorite crater just has to have diamonds.
Now, you were able to work on the Apollo moon rocks.
Yes, correct.
Were there anything indicating diamonds are on the moon?
No. There were several motivations for going to the moon. As John F. Kennedy said, we'll reach the moon within the next decade. A marvelous ambition and an amazing, amazing accomplishment. But what was the real motivation? It's topical now, and that is it was political. We beat the Russians. We beat the USSR. Mm. Secondly, it was an engineering feat. And thirdly, it was to search for the origin of life. So to come back to your question, Joseph, is that no, there's no evidence of primordial carbon in any abundance, and certainly no evidence of diamond. Moreover, even in the core of the moon, the temperatures and pressures are insufficient to form diamond.
We're going to talk about those pressures that are required, right. But citing the article published in National Geographic last year, diamonds have been mined from rivers and streams for some 80 years in the West African nation of Liberia, but sources were elusive until you, Dr. Haggerty, made a discovery. What was it?
This is amazing.
It is.
Okay, the first correction. I don't like the word discover.
Okay, you uncovered. You uncovered something.
It was
okay.
There for a long period of time.
Did you tell National Geographic
no,
you
didn't
like that? Okay.
No, I think I did. There are two words in the English language that I have an objection. One is discover and the other is unique. But that's aside. Right, so what... So diamonds had been known there, the artisanals, the locals, had been mining them, as you correctly say, for at least 80 years that we know of. And all from rivers, streams, somewhat along the coastline, but not too many. When I first went there, my objective was to look for the origin. What was the parent rock of diamond? And that was my strong ambition.
Say that again. Your purpose in going there was to find what?
The parent rock to diamond.
Okay.
The parent rock.
The parent rock to diamond. Okay.
So that would be in the gold context. It would be the bonanza, if you like. Okay. So we're after the parent rock, which teaches us something about the origin of diamonds, the interior of the earth, and of course then there's the commercial aspect to it. But that was my objective. What I recognized very early on, so now I'm talking about 30 years ago now, and I might add, having mentioned the word Liberia, is that it's a case of having to get back between revolutions back into Liberia. But 30 years ago, what I recognized was where the locals were mining diamonds was this rather extraordinary, I called it a tree. It turns out it's a plant. I still have difficulty calling it a plant because this object grows to 20 to 30 meters, 60 feet in height. And so, you might want to call it a plant on steroids, okay? What was so extraordinary about it is that I had not seen these before. And so it had an aerial root system about 2 meters in height, over 6 feet in height, a very tall stem. But one of the other really interesting features is that both the roots, the aerial roots, as well as the palm-like fronds were indurated in thorns or spines, okay? In fact, I've now learned that in the Pacific Ocean, for example, and in fact we have some beautiful examples in Fairchild Gardens that my wife and I love to go to. So around the lake there, if you look carefully, you'll see this mangrove-like a bush. And that's it's the same family that I...
And this is Pandanus candelabrum?
Pandanus candelabrum.
Okay. Pamaya?
The locals call it Pamaya, correct. But the technical botanical term from Kew Gardens and Missouri, it's Pandanus candelabrum. Now, when I went back to this area that we were looking at, found, oh my golly, here's the plant that I'd recognized some 30 years ago, and it was right in the area that we were now looking, where, once again, the artisanals were mining. So we began to dig down. Absolutely, the bush is impenetrable. We call it bush, translated jungle, okay? Mm-hmm. And it is thick and impenetrable. It turns out the pandamas, if you go to Fairchild's garden, just look around the lake and just ask yourself how easy or how difficult would it be to get through this root system. Not very easy.
It's very similar to a mangrove?
It is. It's part of the mangrove entourage of plants and trees, correct, yeah. So, and I was reluctant to cut these down, being an environmentalist. But eventually, we kept finding the so-called indicator minerals, minerals that are associated with diamond. And I knew, therefore, that we were very close to the parent rock, where the rock that the diamonds came out of. Eventually, I said, nope, we've got to remove a couple of these. We did. We dug another pit, and by golly, we then found the parent rock, the mother lode, which was the kimberlite that hosted the diamonds. What we then recognized, I developed a technique for sampling the soil, and eventually found that in fact there was this body 500 meters in length and about 50 meters in width, and it was the solid parent rock hosting diamonds.
We're going to stop right there for a moment. There's a lot more to this story.
And resume in a minute.
We're speaking with geologist and distinguished research professor, Dr. Stephen Haggerty from FIU. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We continue with Dr. Stephen Haggerty of FIU. We're talking about diamonds and their origins, and Dr. Haggerty's jungle forensics, his search for diamonds in Africa. Doctor, tell me more about the kimberlite pipes which the Pandanus candelabrum grow near.
On.
Around.
Well, that was the clue. So when I so we have compositions of the kimberlite, and when I described the composition by pointing out that it was low in iron but high in magnesium, high in potassium, high in sodium, and moreover high in phosphorus. And talking to a botanist and said, well, is there anything special about that soil? And the answer is, by golly, that, you know, that sounds like a good fertilizer. And that's exactly what it is. So this plant then that has seemingly has a great preference for the kimberlite pipes has an affinity for those particular elements.
Okay. I want to go back to where we were, where you know, we're in this bush, literally. Now, let me ask you, if the way you describe it, and you say you're an environmentalist, and so you know, found the mother lode, if this is going to be prospected, if people are going to go there and get the diamonds and destroy all those mangroves or these plants, won't that hurt the environment?
The answer is yes. But one needs to put that into a broader context. What are the locals doing in terms of just farming, for example? So it's slash and burn,
right?
Indiscriminately, and the soil virginity is rapidly lost to the point that maybe we have one or two field seasons of rice and that's it. So here for diamonds. And I'm not making an excuse, but the answer is yes. The pandanus would necessarily be removed, but I have a way, is that we will certainly rehabilitate the area using the kimberlite soil. Now that we know that the pandanus has an affinity for it, is that we will certainly rehabilitate it. But now at least we can also say the locals are not interested, nor indeed can they mine the diamonds from the kimberlite. They can only mine the diamonds that have been liberated from the kimberlite and are in streams and rivers, just by virtue of the fact you need heavy equipment to do that, and certainly water pumps and so on. So the locals will not be mining the kimberlite. Now, any other company, including the company that I consult for, certainly has an ambition and a goal to work this pipe. However, I'm the consulting geologist, and I will make sure that in rehabilitating it is that we reintroduce the pomias and the pandanus candelabrum.
Now, the diamonds that are found on these sites, what percentage are industrial-grade diamonds versus precious gems?
Very good. Good question. We haven't processed sufficient material yet, Joe, to be able to answer that question. They're in the process of doing that right now. But my estimate is based on...
And they're leaning toward precious gems.
Yes, that's the ultimate hope. But based on a global distribution, we're safe to say that probably 10, maybe 20% would be the hope, would be gems, and the other 80% would be industrial.
Talk about the industrial uses for diamonds. You said it's important.
Absolutely. Right, so because of its extreme hardness, it's used extensively. In fact, in coming to the studio this morning, I passed some people who are digging up the roads just like in building. They're all using diamond saws. So the saws that are using for cutting the rock are all embedded in diamonds. So that's one use. Polishing almost any gemstone requires a diamond paste. But now they're also using diamonds for... and ultimately, we'll start using diamonds in... they're used in watches, for example. The other point I need to make is that diamond has these extraordinary physical properties. And once word, I don't like the word unique. But for example, the thermal conductivity, the rate at which heat will move through diamond, is 6 times greater than that of copper.
It conducts that much.
It conducts that fast. And that's the principle that we use, or De Beers used, and now we can buy these little meters that essentially are thermal conductivity meters to distinguish between simulants, such as cubic zirconia, fabulite, and real diamond. So it's 6 times greater than that of copper. Okay, So that's the other use. Ultimately, by producing very thin, synthetically, very thin layers of diamond, that will be the next stage for the introduction in computers, for example. The principle being, we have two diodes. The closer the diodes, the faster we can transmit information. But the closer the diodes, the greater the heat production. So currently we're using gold, for example, in the boards, but ultimately it'll be diamond.
We don't have that long, so I want to cover some things because it's so fascinating. We want to get to the subject of the synthetic diamonds too, but talk about how a diamond is formed, how deep it is in the earth, how it moves, what speed it moves at in order to become a diamond from carbon. Talk about that because it's so fascinating.
Right. So this is, some of it is speculative, but this is generally the accepted word in scientific circles. So we have this tremendous age, 3 billion years. The rate at which diamonds form is down in the deep earth is not accurately known. How deep? The minimum temperatures and pressures that are required down in the earth are at least 200 kilometers. That's 120 miles. In other words, we're talking about, so let's put this into a thumbnail skit. We're talking about the distance from Key West through Miami, going north at least to Fort Lauderdale, down.
Okay.
So just take that. What does it take you? 2.5 hours to drive down there, down into the earth.
From That's Fort Lauderdale to Key West?
Correct.
Longer than that.
Yeah, a little longer. But anyway.
Maybe 3.5.
But still, we know ahead. About that distance.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's the distance down. That's the minimum distance. We have diamonds from Africa and Brazil that we can demonstrate formed at 660 kilometers down. This is in the lower mantle. So the carbon was there, the diamonds formed, they're very ancient, but the growth also meant that the principles, the fluids, the magma that created the diamond was also capable of dissolving the diamond. So we have this give and take of growth and dissolution, and we can see that in a diamond. Many diamonds are very complexly, almost as a tree grows, for example. So
they were getting smaller as they rose.
They can get smaller, but they can be big ones. Okay. Now, the other point we know is that the field in which the diamonds form is heterogeneous. It's not homogeneous. So we have pockets probably where large diamonds formed, and in other pockets where diamonds were being dissolved. Now, what happens next is also very exciting. That teaches us a lot about the interior workings of the earth, and that is that the diamonds are brought down from these extraordinary great depths to the surface at particular times in Earth's history. One was about 1 billion years ago, and the other about 100 million years ago. So we have these extraordinary features of diamond. They formed at 3 billion years, but they only came to the surface at 1 billion years and then again at 100 million years. Yes, we have other eruptions that have brought up diamond, but those are it's synchronous. All over the Earth are those major events. How fast? It had to be fast because, how fast? At least one or twice the speed of sound. So we're talking about meters per second, or certainly within days, to come from great 660 kilometers to the surface, perhaps a day and a half. And it had to be fast. Why? Because diamond will change to graphite.
If it's not fast, correct. It'll go back to
the carbon from which it originally formed.
From which it arose.
Correct. Now you might ask, well, how is it possible to have diamonds adorning one's ear, perhaps embedded in one's nose, and other parts of the anatomy? How is it possible that it doesn't go to graphite? Well, the ladies would say, thankfully, it doesn't. Okay.
Yes, of course they would. Listen, we want to mention.
We haven't noticed, Doctor, though, that you are completely unadorned.
Yes,
no rings.
We did.
No rings.
Well, you mentioned at first that you have no interest in him in that respect.
There's so much more that's much more interesting than just the adornment.
Now, does your wife feel the same?
She does, as a matter of fact. Tanya, you listening?
Yes. Well, we want to say that Dr. Stephen Haggerty is going to be on NBC 6 tonight at 6, actually. We wanted to talk about what he's going to be talking about then, but We don't have the time to do it, which is the subject of synthetic diamonds and simulated diamonds, but it has been such a pleasure to have you. You'll have to come back. Dr. Stephen
Haggerty. We'll do more research for your next visit.
Yes, yes, yes. And we'll adorn ourselves. Distinguished Research Professor, Department of Earth and Environment in the College of Arts and Sciences at Florida International University. You want to give out your email?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, it's Haggerty at FIU.edu, and that's Haggerty. It's been fascinating, truly.
Well, thanks for the invitation. It's been fun.
We enjoyed it. Thank you.
We'll be back with more. And we continue on today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you on this Valentine's Day. It's said that February is the most popular month for relationship breakups. Now, that might seem odd since Valentine's Day is within the month, but maybe and that's the cause.
Well, it could be. And the Tuesday before Valentine's Day is tops for shedding relationships. That would have been yesterday. It's even called Red Tuesday. So today we ask the question, how does a broken heart deal with all the lovely sentiments of Valentine's? With us is life and relationship consultant, motivational speaker and author, Barb Boschetto. She joins us from San Mateo, California. Welcome to you, Barb.
Thank you so much, Joseph and Bonnie. I'm excited about this one. And happy Valentine's Day.
Well, happy Valentine's Day to you. Do you have a Valentine?
Not this Valentine's Day. I have several little Valentines.
Okay. So clearly we don't all have Valentines. What have you found are the best ways for those without to deal with the romance of Valentine's Day, especially if you've recently broken up or you're still grieving?
I know. It's interesting. I was walking down the street and this young girl said to her mother yesterday, "Oh, God, it's Valentine's Day. I just can't handle it." And, of course, I speeded up and I said, "Excuse me." I said, "I'd love to hear your take on this." And she goes, "Oh, it's the lovey couples." And it's, I said, "But are you out of relationship by choice?" And she goes, "Well, I've been for a little bit." And she goes, "I guess I just really want it." And I said, "Oh, that's interesting." And she couldn't answer too many more questions. Of course, she was with her mom, and she was about maybe 21, 22. But I find it really interesting about this, because there are several people who have to have a relationship. It's so important to them. And then when they do see couples, it really, really bothers them, and it's something about themselves, actually, is what it's bothering. And most people get so far away from their own selves and their own needs, they think somebody else needs to fill that for them. Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting, because God, Bonnie and Joseph, think about this day. Actually, if you really take a look at it, it's a beautiful day. There's people getting out and actually, and we can get on the materialism of it, but there's people actually going out and having a thought process about what they want to do for someone else. And people are a little bit happier today. The children are happier. Everybody's happier. So if you want to find love in the moment. And if you don't have that partner, there's so much beauty out there to take a good look at if you're willing to open up to that.
So you could buy a box of Penny Valentine's Day and give them to people you know at the office or... Even hand them out on the street, I guess.
Hand them out on the street. Go by with a quarter and have a little sticker on the meter and put a quarter in and put a sticker on. There's so many different things. And people do get caught up in the materialism. It's very interesting how a lot of the talk lately has been the pressure to purchase, the pressure to purchase. Well, we're doing that to ourselves. They could put it out for us, but we're doing that to ourselves. It costs nothing to download love songs or your loved one's favorite songs. In fact, that's something I do for all my children every Valentine's Day, is I go through and find my favorite love songs of whatever the year, and sure, some of them are repeated, and sure, someday I'll find them at the bottom of all their drawers, but I label their names, the year of the Valentine's, and I give it to them. That's their Valentine's Day gift.
Well, I looked at... I'm sorry, go on. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't have to cost.
I was looking at that Red Tuesday clip and why it's called Red Tuesday and all the breakups the day before, and a lot of the reasons were economically based, that people did not want to have to spend, you know, all the money that they would have had to spend.
So instead of taking her out to dinner and then to the symphony, I'll avoid
and the gift and the flowers and all that.
Yeah. But you know, honestly, that's a true true excuse, because if you really love someone, you're going to want to spend time with them and you're going to want to make them happy. And you don't, like I said, you don't need to get caught up in the materialism. And if mm-hmm. that's the kind of person that wants it, you need to break up. You don't need that in your life, especially in today's economy and the way the world's going. There's so many other ways that you can enjoy the day and make it beautiful and special. But if you truly want to be with someone, you're not going to do that. So it's actually it's a blessing. It's a redo for you in your life. And if you look at it negatively and are heartbroken, you probably could look back and see the signs.
Well, go ahead.
Well, Barb, do some people then experience Valentine's Day as the same way that some people are depressed around the Christmas holidays?
And the holidays, Yeah, you know what we all do for ourselves? We put ourselves on a map, and we follow this map, and we follow the traditions, and we follow all these things, and we tell ourselves that's the way it's supposed to be. And it really does not need to. You can change that at any given time. You can change your mapping and change where you've gone, and don't follow down that same path, because it's going to bring on the same onset memories triggering you as you go along. And I think the expectations... the saying goes, peace begins when expectations end. If you relieve yourself of all the expectations, you'll find a new way.
What advice do you have for the newly single person to fill the void left by a former partner? Is it best, do you say it's best just to be alone for a while, stay alone, get to know yourself, deal with the, and find out, you know, maybe look more at yourself during that time instead of just automatically going to another relationship?
Don't go, because usually red flags, and you can usually tell the person who's done the damage in a relationship, because they're the ones that are quickest to have a new person. But there's also, it depends on the level of your pain. Sometimes people just go, they need someone so badly, they just jump into another relationship and can't understand why they're doing the same thing over and over again. And they're manifesting that. Can you imagine that? So they're creating that. The best thing you can do for yourself and the best love you can create is your own self-love and understanding who you are. Now, some breakups, and it depends, this isn't a blanket, but some breakups you do need to take a moment to understand who that person is that just broke up, because there's aspects of that person within you. And if you don't address that, you're going to go out and you're going to attract that over again. And it's so important to take that moment and really sit with yourself. A lot of people are very, very afraid to do that. A lot of people mm-hmm. don't know how to do that.
Right.
And they don't like being alone.
Now, Bonnie, I don't know if this is too personal or not, but you have something in front of you that looks like it's a little red man inside the cellophane.
Well,
it almost looks like a crucifix.
No, it's not that. This was given to me by our producer of today, Polly Landis. It's Grow a Boyfriend. So it grows up to 4 times its size in water. And the best thing about it is it takes 72 hours to get to full size, which is 4 times this size, which makes it about 8 inches total, right?
Yeah.
And then, Joe,
I'm not saying anything.
No. And then you can take it out of the water and it shrinks again and you can grow it again. So you have your own boyfriend.
I think I've heard that before. yes, but the thing is to really understand what you do want in a person. A lot of times we just jump from relationship just because it feels good in the moment. And you know how feelings go. They shift and they change. So then disappointment comes on. And it's really, really important to take the moment and really understand what it is you want and who you are, not just what you want, but who you are too. And a quick way, Bonnie and Joe, a quick way to answer that is if you ask yourself, what is it you want, and you can't answer that, you have lost yourself. And an unhealthy person cannot answer that question. A healthy person can tell you what they want and what they want out of life and what their next move is. But an unhealthy person just can't even see that because they've been so wrapped up in the relationships of others. They've lost their identity.
I'm noncommittal on this.
Well, let's open the phones to our listeners. Are you Valentine-less today? Did you break up on Red Tuesday or maybe a few days before? And are you happier being single and finding out about yourself, or are you happy in a relationship? The number?
Our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email radio@WLRN.org. radio WLRN.org.
I mean, relationships aren't necessarily for everybody, are they, Barb?
They're not for everybody, but they're not for everybody because they don't understand. Again, it goes back to true self, but they don't understand what it is. There's a lot of people that don't want to go into a relationship because they find it's a hassle. But why is it a hassle? It's partly because of who you are and your understanding of relationships. Actually, love and relationship and commitment is simple. People complicate it.
In what
it's
ways?
Very, very simple. In triggering past emotions without understanding themselves, there's certain things about their past that they'll bring into a new relationship and say that this relationship is difficult without realizing they're the difficult ones because they're bringing things from the past forward. And it can go as early as your first relationship or your parents. And even if you love your parents to death, there might be something within that relationship that moves you into, triggers you all in all the relationships moving forward. And that's a little bit deeper. So let's kind of stay on the fluffy part is they just don't want to put in the time and effort. Now, these are very interesting people because they might be the person that overworks at work. Now, why do they do that? It's because they're avoiding relationships. And some people do not want to be hurt. It's not about the hassle of the relationship, but they're so worried about being hurt or being vulnerable and exposed, and they don't want their true self to be seen. And it's an interesting, and it goes back to self-discovery. Reclaiming who you are and moving forward, life becomes easy when you understand yourself. But, Bonnie and Joe, there's a big generation that, if you said self-love, they would have thought that you were, oh, that's selfish, I can't do that, I'm here to love my husband, I'm here to love my children, I'm here to love my friends, my wife, and it was an ego-based thought, and they thought, I can't do that. The truth of the matter is, if it doesn't start with you, there's not a relationship outside of that that will come very easy.
We're speaking with Barb Boschetto. She's a life, relationship, and motivational consultant, speaker, and author. And we're talking about, well, how to have a healthy relationship, maybe. And our number, if you'd like to call, is 1-800-743-9576. How are you feeling this Valentine's Day? 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@WLRN.org. We'll be right back.
And we're back with today's Topical Currents, Valentine's Day edition, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We're speaking with life and relationship consultant and motivational speaker and author Barb Boschetto. She's joining us from San Mateo, California. If you'd like to join in, we do have lines open, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Continuing on with Valentine's Day, Barb, some people, though, I think... maybe even like me, kind of feel that Valentine's Day kind of lump it in like with Mother's Day and Father's Day, that it's just kind of a Hallmark thing and it's a commercial opportunity and just really don't take it very seriously.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there are some people that don't, but if you happen to come across a partner, and it's okay to feel what you feel and believe what you believe, but if you have a partner and you're in a relationship and this means something to that person, then it should mean something to the person who does not believe to want to please the other.
Yeah.
Now, if that doesn't take place, again, you're in the wrong relationship with the wrong person. It doesn't mean you need to go find someone who thinks and believes the way you do. You need to go find someone that you want to make happy and see a smile on their face. And that's the difference.
Do men and women generally handle breakups differently?
A little off, a little bit different. I think, and honestly, the men that I've worked with lately seem to, they stay quiet, they withhold, they don't want to bring out their true feelings, and they hold on just a little bit before they open up. Now, women will get very emotional right away. And most women will, and depending on your background, and then they will speak. But usually when you respond so quickly, it's really not from the heart. It's just from the ego trying to spew things out and get it out. one of the things I find interesting, if you really take a look at it, and if one person's ready to move on and they break up or they maybe even cheat on another person, what you don't understand, there's one person who has a whole and complete heart, and they're ready to move on and they're moving out. The other person is left broken, and it's not, and they didn't stop loving. So there's a difference between the two. One had stopped loving and ready to move on, and the other one did not stop loving. So then they have to adjust to that and understand why it's taking them a little bit longer. Why are they so broken up? Well, the truth of the matter, there's a big difference between a broken heart and a heart that's whole and moving on. And if you can sit in that moment.
Liz writes that, I think she misunderstood you, but she says, respectfully, I disagree with your comments, relationships being a hassle. I love my own time, my dog, painting, my career, my trainers, friends. This leaves no time for a relationship. I find men to be too demanding.
But she does have relationships.
Right.
She has them with her friends, and she has them with her dogs, and she's happy. It doesn't mean you have to be in a relationship with the opposite
right.
sex either. You can be happily in relationships without having a partner. I think the world puts too much pressure on relationships. I was in a 30-year committed marriage. I was monogamous for 32 years of my life to one person. No sooner than the breakup happens, and I'm not even filing for divorce yet, people are asking me, am I going to date? Who am I going to go out with? And I was a little blinded by that. And then when I was finally free, I thought, how funny. The world puts such a pressure on relationships, and if you really take a good look, and I kind of have to agree with the comment, there are a lot of unhappy people out there, a lot of unhappy people, but there's a lot of people that give up, and there is that person out there for you, that person, but if you're out seeking it, you're going to get upset, you're going to be flustered because you're seeking it. The person will come to you, trust the timing, trust the process. The right person will show up. It means you love your dog, you love your friends, you enjoy staying home, reading, writing, knitting, watching TV, whatever, because the right timing and the right place will come.
And we'll move along to a caller, Nick in Fort Lauderdale. Nick, hi.
Good afternoon. How are you all?
Good.
Hi, Nick.
Go ahead, Nick.
Yes, my question is, I entered a relationship about 6 months ago. And my question is, my partner, my former partner, immediately got into a relationship because he met the individual online. I'm wondering earlier you stated that the person who gets into relationship immediately after that, this should be a cause for concern.
Yeah.
Is that normal? And does online dating or have access to dating sites, is that because that's so prevalent now, is that still the case?
It's so prevalent, and it's very easy for people, but here it is. Easy for the ones who are looking. And I don't want to say too much because I don't know your full story and your full background. And
sure.
There were probably things that you saw or knew beforehand, because generally the person that moves on so quickly wasn't as committed as one would believe. And either they were already stepping into the water a little early and being ready to make the move, and the other person is left devastated and trying to pick up the pieces and figure it out. And generally the case is the person that is doing the damage will move on much quicker. It's not because they're healthy in relationship, it's not because they're so good at it or that they're so attractive or that some people move into relationships quickly because they want to prove that they are so good at relationships and it wasn't me, I've got to have another relationship.
Well,
I'll show you, you know.
Of course, you're speaking very generally, correct?
I am, because it's a broad, I know we're talking to a broad spectrum right now, so I'm speaking very general.
Okay.
Okay, well, Nick, well, anything else?
It was the best decision I ever made. I'm much happier and learned a lot. And I'm going to use that information when I go forward in other relationships.
That's great.
Yes. And take a good look at him. Really do. Because whatever it is that you loved in him, those parts are in you. And whatever that you find later that was frustrating, that would just got you, those parts are in you too. and you want them out because you don't want those to enter into the next relationship.
Excellent.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you
Nick.
All.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
And Eric writes, would you ask Barb about the adage, women mourn, men replace, regarding endings of relationships?
Are you ready for me? Is that it?
Sure, sure. That was it.
I don't truly believe that.
Okay.
I do know that when a spouse passes, a man gets very lonely and he looks for someone almost immediately. It shocks their family how quickly he'll find someone, where a woman will wait a little bit longer. I think in today's age and the emotional intelligence, everybody is so much more emotionally intelligent than they once were before, that I think men are taking their time, and I think men are a little bit more aware. I don't like generalizations of men and women for this reason. Pain has no gender, and it everybody is very, very individual. And when we get caught up into those cliches, then we dismiss assisting those in need of change.
Right. Well, Barb Boschetto is a life, relationship, and motivational consultant. She's also a speaker and an author, and she joined us from San Mateo, California. Thank you so much, Barb.
Thank you, Barb.
Oh, thank you, guys. Happy Valentine's Day, and just love the day.
Yes, and happy Valentine's Day to you.
And to you as
well. Okay.
Thanks so
thank
much for
you.
Joining us.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, happy Valentine's Day, Bonnie.
Well, Joe, same to you. Thank
happy
you.
Happy Valentine's Day to our producer, Polly Landis, who gave us some nice chocolate.
And to our technical director, Jason Zabka.
And Richard Ives.
And to Richard Ives, our lead producer.
We
and to all
it.
Of you, happy Valentine's Day.
And don't forget, we have free audio archives at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, an iTunes podcast, as well as the Topical Currents Facebook page. Sorry I didn't get you that diamond.
Well, listen, next year.
Next year, indeed. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Bonnie and I return Monday with a program which begins with a tribute to UNICEF, now celebrating its 70th anniversary.
We'll return Thursday.
Thursday, indeed. Students help keep the efforts of UNICEF active locally from high schools and area universities as well. Also on Thursday, Linda Gastenheimer and TV chef Vivian Howard, host of PBS's A Chef's Life. She'll be joining us from her restaurant in North Carolina. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.